The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. So good evening again. And tonight I'd like to build a little bit on something that I started to talk about last Monday. This idea of working with our emotions. Such a big topic. So much we could do with this. And as I mentioned, or I think I mentioned, or I plan to mention, that part of one way that we can work with our emotions is to look at, investigate, inquire about some of our underlying beliefs that might be supporting or fueling our emotions. What are some of the belief structures, or what are some of the thoughts that are maybe very quietly in the back of our minds, but what are some of the thoughts that keep particular emotions going? Kind of, I like this idea of fueling them. You know, providing the oomph to keep them going. And as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the meditation, that there is this one theme that I've noticed. Of course, I've noticed it in myself, and I've noticed it in many of us. Many of us, it's very, very prevalent. Not just in Dharma practitioners, but I suspect in probably the Western kind of culture, if I dare be so bold as to say something like that. That is this idea of what I'll call, and others call, the inner critic. This idea of like, oh, I should be doing it better. I should be doing it differently. I'm doing it wrong. I have to be better, or something like this, some version of that. It's quite remarkable how common this is. So, if you might have thought that you were the only one, and that everybody else maybe has some version of has all their ducks in a row, but this turns out to be quite prevalent. So this inner critic, this I read now, I don't remember where, but someone describing it as it's like that bad roommate that's always there and, you know, saying something to you, like, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. Or, but maybe we could also understand it almost like a sub-personality, and understand in some kind of way that's inside of us, that's constantly putting us down, belittling us. It's the self-judgment, or blaming ourselves, or being critical, or nagging at us. And with this, there might be this diffuse and pervasive, but not quite clear, sense of shame that goes with it. A sense of shame for what we are, or how we are, or who we are in some kind of way. With this, also with a sense of harshness, the tone of the voice of this roommate, subpersonality, however you want to imagine it, isn't a voice of kindness. Instead, it's a voice of harshness. And it's not just a voice, it's also maybe a dynamic or a constellation of experiences in the body, thoughts in the mind, maybe attitudes or moods, that some are subtle and some of them are not so subtle. They may feel familiar, because we have seen it for so long, for quite some time. But there's this feeling of inadequacy as part of the inner critic, this idea of whatever I'm doing, it's not enough. or however I am, it's not quite good enough. And it's understandable that we have this. Many of us, we've learned this from family, from culture, from school. It's a society. It's a phenomenon. So we don't have to blame ourselves. We're not the only ones. And we just didn't make it out of whole cloth. We didn't make it for no particular reason. We don't have to be critical of ourselves for having this inner critic. But there are a number of ways in which this inner critic impacts us. And I'll just talk about a few here. One is it leads to a dampening or a repression of an expression of ourselves. This feeling that we shouldn't express who we are. We should only maybe express a small bit, not the whole portion of who we are. And this, of course, kind of like dampens and represses our creativity and our feelings of intimacy with others. And this sense of not being able to fully show up kind of leads to a certain type of frustration. Certainly some dissatisfaction. And this frustration and dissatisfaction can lead to some anger or some, you know, maybe it's not quite clear, it's this diffuse, vague sense of anger about how things are without a clear sense of why they are that way. Or so our being feels kind of squelched, and which leads to frustration, which leads to some anger, which might lead to some hostility. Another way that the inner critic impacts us is this sense of should comes into the practice. That I should behave a certain way. I should not behave this other way. Shows up in our lives, and also the inner critic specifically into our practice, into our meditation practice, can have this sense of, you know, I should meditate more, I should be concentrated. My mind shouldn't be wandering away. Or if you're doing loving kindness practice, I should be more loving. Dang it. So this idea of should creates a sense of pressure that I was pointing to with the guided meditation. And this pressure, in turn, this sense of pressure can block or cramp or inhibit or somehow shut down or end our whole meditation practice because it's so uncomfortable, this sense of should. And in that kind of way, it kind of like squeezes the sense of joy, juice or joy out of our practice. Instead, our meditation practice becomes burdensome and something we're supposed to be doing. But there isn't any lightness to it. There isn't any sense of spaciousness and opportunity there. Instead, it feels like a drudgery. Maybe it feels dry or brittle or something. And also, an impact of the inner critic is it can squelch a sense of our asking ourselves really deep questions, including the questions of what are my highest aspirations? What's really important for me? What do I want in my life? How can my life unfold in a way that's meaningful for me? How might I live my life now so that at the end of my life, I feel like, yes, I lived it according to what was important, meaningful for me? These are just a few of the ways in which the inner critic can show up, some of the impact that it has. Kind of this feeling of our creativity being not being expressed, maybe our intimacy, not having intimacy with others, that not being expressed. Of a feeling of should, which kind of comes from this pressure, or maybe should and pressure, the way that they're kind of related, they reinforce one another, which then impacts our meditation practice and perhaps any other thing that we feel like that could be cultivated or developed, not just meditation practice. And get in the way of asking some deep questions of, well, what do I really want for my life? If the inner critic is really strong, we don't want to ask those questions. We're afraid that the next thing might be, oh, well, you can't do it anyway. So there are difficulties in our lives. It's part of the human experience. And the Buddha, of course, pointed to this in the First Noble Truth. There is suffering. There are difficulties. Things are unsatisfactory. So instead of allowing the inner critic to jump in really quickly and say, this is not okay, and because I'm uncomfortable, it means that I'm doing something wrong, that I'm bad, or something like that, some version of that. Instead of having this feeling like, what am I doing wrong? How am I wrong as a person, or something like that? Can we ask the question, what is underlying this suffering? What is the cause of this difficulty? What are the conditions that made this sense of unsatisfactoriness, this sense of unease arise? So instead of this feeling of, instead of this question of, am I doing it right? This question becomes, how am I? What can I do to support myself right now? There's difficulties. What would be helpful? There's difficulties. What would be something that can create more of a sense of openness or a sense of a way forward, as opposed to, how am I doing this wrong? Or how can I make this go away, of course, too? So the Buddha introduced some of his key teachings, or this shift from a concern from how am I, or what am I, or how am I doing it wrong, this sense of maybe a concern with the essence of who we are, and more with a shift to an emphasis on what would be helpful, or what's skillful, or what can be done in this moment. So rather than the inner critic becoming this pervasive, vague sense of shame, can ask, what's helpful, what's not? Instead of falling into this feeling of something in my essence, something about who I am, is wrong. Instead, this recognition that there's a web of conditions, there are so many things that contributed to every experience that we have in every moment. And so for us to kind of look towards that, what are the conditions and what are the actions, as opposed to this feeling of how what is it that I'm doing wrong? How am I wrong? So The inner critic can work by singling something out in our experience and making that significant. This is kind of like the seed gets planted, often from some insignificant thing. Not always, but sometimes. It might be an email that we receive that has a tone that isn't quite right, or maybe the ending or the salutation or the ending. I'm not sure what that's called. That maybe it's the ending salutation, the way that they close their email. This wasn't in a way that maybe felt what you were expecting, or maybe didn't feel warm to you, or I'm just making this up. And then a whole story can be like, oh, this person doesn't really want to talk to me, doesn't really want to email me. They are just doing this because they feel like they want to, or I mean, they don't want to, but they're just doing this because they feel like they should. I'm a bad person. And because I'm a bad person, or probably nobody wants to send me an email, right? It's our minds can do, we can go to some really scary places. But notice how if we reflect back, chances are, at that time there were so many things happening. I mean, the computer was on maybe just a few minutes before. There was something supportive and wholesome was in an email or something that was on our computer. Or at that same time, we were most likely maybe not sitting in a chair or maybe looking at our phones. Maybe there was music going on. Maybe there were sounds going on. And maybe there were some neutral things to look at. Maybe there were some pleasant things to look at. Maybe we had other emails during the day that were completely neutral, maybe some that were pleasant. Maybe we had a Zoom meeting with somebody, some that had pleasant moments and unpleasant moments. My point is, of course, that we just choose one single thing and really grab onto it and hang on to it, and we give it a significance, make it an importance about it. And then we build a self around it. I'm not a good person. I'm a bad person. I'm a person that people don't really want to communicate with or something. Maybe this is, I'm using exaggerated language, but often there's a form of this that's happening a lot during our days. Maybe it's not so obvious as this idea of I'm a bad person, but out of the countless experiences, that events that occur in a day, we single out one and make it really significant. So that's partly how the inner critic works, is it just grabs onto something and runs with it. Another one is, and it's related to this, is the inner critic works by overestimating the centrality, the importance of our sense of self. Like going on with this example I gave earlier about receiving an email that didn't feel quite right, or maybe wasn't as warm as we had hoped, or whatever it might have been. We don't know the conditions of when that person was sending the email, of course, right? Maybe they were on their phone and something else was happening and they just needed to get off the phone quickly, or wanted to get off the phone quickly because they were about ready, the light had changed and they were going to walk across the street. Or maybe somebody in their household needed their attention for something, so moved that way. But we often think it's all about us. We all often think about that. It's just because of us that email had that way, arrived. They sent that email that way. But as I pointed to earlier, this recognition that there are so many conditions for every single moment. It's not all about us. But the inner critic starts to think that it is. There's other ways in which the inner critic works, but I'll just offer those two. This one that it singles out a single singles out a particular event and makes it very significant. And then it has this, our sense of self as having a real sense of centrality, of importance. So of course, some of the ways that we can work with this is just to notice these two things. And that in some ways that can kind of like take some of the power away from, or take some of the authority away from this voice of this inner critic. There are so many different ways in which we can work with this. So I'll just offer a few things here. And as I said, mindfulness, that is just being aware of our experience of what's happening in the moment. But not just any old mindfulness, not just feeling the sensations in our bodies or noticing the quality of our mind, as well as maybe the actual voices, what they're saying. Like, ah, you're an idiot, or that person doesn't like you, they're never going to like you, or nobody likes you. You're not a likable person. So not only noticing maybe some of the things that we can hear, the voice says to ourselves, but also can we notice the tone of the voice that the inner critic has? And with mindfulness, to also notice the tone of our mindfulness. Kindness is a natural part of mindfulness. Kindness is a way that which we do kind of like bring our attention to our experience. But can we emphasize that kindness? Can we emphasize a sense of spaciousness or open-heartedness related to our mindfulness, and the way in which we notice the bodily sensations that might be associated with the inner critic, that sense of pressure, that sense of tightness. Maybe there's a sense of frustration or sense of constriction. But can we do the noticing with a sense of kindness, not critical? It might be that the inner critic is so familiar to us that we're kind of critical of the inner critic, and of course we know where that's going to go. It's just going to go round and around. So as best you can, to bring some awareness to the experience of the inner critic, and even if not to even with the inner critic, but to our experience, whatever our experiences might be, with some kindness, some warm-heartedness. Can we emphasize it? This idea of this affectionate curiosity. This attention with a quality of befriending. And with that, this mindfulness is just letting the inner critic be there. Just letting it be there. This is the opposite of often kind of the knee-jerk wish to want it to, you know, get out of here, go away. It's painful. It's uncomfortable. It's difficult. We talked about this, right? Some of the bodily sensation might be really uncomfortable. But can we let it be there? And one way to do that is to give it some space, to have some openness to it. So rather than trying to shove it away, can there be an attitude of spaciousness? And this might mean really big space. But if there's just a little bit of spaciousness, our inner critic could just fill that up. So as spacious as we can, what does that mean to be spacious? Means really, it's about allowing. Is there a way in which our mindfulness practice can have a sense of allowing? Allowing the inner critic, allowing whatever's arising then, at that moment, our experience. So, then we can find that in this space, other qualities of heart, other qualities of mind might have room to show up. Something other than this aversion. There might be a little bit of ease. There might be a little bit of warm-heartedness that shows up in that space. So rather than the screaming or the badgering, the kind of this maybe insidious whisper that we hear, is there a way in that we can bring some warm-hearted attention to it and some spaciousness to it? And then maybe I'll offer this other thing here that can drop in this question. Am I believing this? Is this true? Is this right? Am I believing it? What's my relationship to this? And that, just asking the question, is this true? Am I believing this? Am I believing this? Maybe, is this true? Maybe that's not the best question, because we can convince ourselves that most anything is true, right? And we're in the grips of the inner critic. Our perception is colored. So maybe the better question is, am I believing this? And then just asking this question just drops in a little bit of doubt. And doubt is something that isn't present when there's the inner critic. So doubt, just this little bit of doubt, also can help create space. And maybe it can be this affectionate sense of, is this, am I believing this? Am I going along with this? So some different ways that we might work with the inner critic is with some mindfulness that's in a warm-hearted way, in a way that allows space. So that is, rather than just narrowing in, there's more of a kind of relaxed way, mindfulness that maybe is like a little feather as opposed to a sledgehammer. And then to drop in this question, am I believing this? Drop in just a little bit of doubt. We can find that these three things, the warmth, the spaciousness, and the doubt, can all support one another and kind of helping us be free from the grip of the inner critic, or at least lessen the authority. And that, then that lessening of authority then can make room for something else to arise. And sometimes when the inner critic is really strong, we don't feel the courage to make changes. We don't feel the courage to look at ourselves, to ways we might be able to do things differently. But I think what's happening in our society right now is asking us to be courageous and is asking us to look at ourselves, asking us to make a difference. So in this way, working with the inner critic can be part of creating the world, a world in which we all want to live in. A world without racism, a world with equalities, a world with warmth and care. So may our practice today support our creating that world together. Thank you.